sound around us, and we'll continue with this event. My name is Mingxi Xian. I'm from Quantucket, and it's also the hometown of Uncle Tom and Injun Joe. It's the town I was born in. And what more do you need to know? Well, I'm Mahikanu and Mohawk, on my mom's side Cherokee, also Mongolian, and African as well. So I have the blood of humankind running through me, and I'm indigenous to Quantucket. So here we go.
That was Mingxi Xian Rosy, who's a man of many, who has many hats as a musician, an educator, and a composer, but he's probably best known for his Afro-Algonquin group, which he formed with the drummer Rashid Ali. Thank you, Mingxi Xian.
And we would like to offer you a very warm welcome for coming out to this event, Building Solidarity Across Black, Native American, and Palestinian Struggles, which is co-sponsored by Scientific Soul Sessions, Adela, New York, and with crucial support from Native Resistance Network. This event is part of the 9th annual Israeli Apartheid Week, which is a series of events held in over 200 cities around the world to raise awareness of Israel's role as an apartheid state, and to bolster, and to bolster support for boycott, divestment, sanctions campaigns. So just to say one quick word about the sponsoring organizations, Adela New York, the New York Campaign for the Boycott of Israel, is a grassroots strategic alliance established in 2006 of organizations and individuals demanding an immediate, unconditional, and permanent end to U.S.-sponsored Israeli aggression in the Middle East, in particular through supporting the Palestinian civil society call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions through a variety of sustained campaigns, protests, and cultural and educational events.
And Scientific Soul Sessions is a group that was formed about 3 years ago by a small collective of individuals, mostly oppressed nationalities, but a few anti-imperialist white folk, who wanted to come together and create a really new, never-before-seen revolutionary movement based upon indigeneity, matriarchy, and most importantly with the leadership of oppressed nationalities and women to end the capitalist system, which we don't feel is fixable or can be reformed in any way. I'm particularly happy to be sharing this event and the co-sponsorship of it with Adala, because one of SSS's primary campaigns is to free a political prisoner and former Black Panther named Russell Maroon Schultz, whose new book is in the back of the room. And we feel that the struggles that are being celebrated today are primarily struggles against racial segregation and apartheid. And in the United States, that segregation of Black peoples in this country is primarily being executed through the prison system. So we feel that this is a really timely and valuable collaboration. We thank you all for being here. And if you could take a moment to silence your cell phones, that would be great. Thank you. Church. This is Joel Covell, author of the acclaimed Overcoming Zionism and co-founder of Eco-Socialist Horizon.
So happy to see you here. Happy to see you as part of the tradition of this church, a church that has its motto, be not afraid, perhaps the most common phrase in the New Testament. It has an illustrious history of fighting injustice in all its forms. So we open our arms to you here, and we are very, very happy to see you. There's one thing at the very beginning that I want to ask of you, and that is that we have a moment of silence to respect the fact that today, March 16th, happens to be the 10th anniversary the murder of Rachel Corrie by a bulldozer manned by a soldier in the Israeli Defense Force and given to the State of Israel by the United States and the Caterpillar Corporation. And it's not the time to go into any detail about that. Certainly Rachel Corrie is not the sole victim of this nightmare. We should bear in mind that no fewer than 7 Palestinians have been murdered in cold blood this very year, individually, by the IDF in the territories, and that will keep going on until the injustices are healed. But I would like us to commemorate this silence because of what is special, in fact, about Rachel Corrie's case is the window it opens on the deep complicity of the United States in the crimes of Israel and the deep injustices of Israel itself, because nothing was ever done to right this wrong. So let us just be silent for a minute and contemplate what has happened and what is going to happen. And now we begin. We've been told that this is a function of Israeli Apartheid Week, and indeed it is, a terminal function, but it has a somewhat different logic, and I think it's a very remarkable logic and one that has to be expanded. Because we take the view, and we're here to express that view. Is this better? Should I pick it up? What's that? Okay, sorry. Thank you. Woo-hoo. Anyhow, it is essential to recognize that the tragedy and the eventual triumph of Palestine will be part of a larger logic, which is the invasion by empire, the displacement of peoples who are indigenous to an area, and their imposition, the imposition of imperial rule and colonial rule. Now, it's particularly important because the United States is deeply involved in this from the very beginning, as you know. So our empire was the westward expansion of Europe, which guaranteed it hegemony over the remainder of history up to this point. In the course of that, needless to say, tens of millions of indigenous people were exterminated. And along with that, tens of millions of Africans were invaded in their own homes and brought over here. So we have the work of plantations. So we have the twofold crime of empire, which curses the history of this country. And now, the latest Western empire that in the historic land of Palestine. So our job, and the logic of our job, is to create the solidarity between the various movements of resistance that have arisen against these imperial incursions. And it's very necessary to do so. So we must learn to see each people as having a particular story, a particular struggle, but also a common struggle and a common story. And the building of resistance across these lines is what is necessary, in my view. That is, not simply to take piecemeal each crime as empire has committed it, but to recognize the unity of such crimes and the collectivities of all the peoples and of all the resistance forces. So what we're doing today to wind up Israel Apartheid Week is, in a sense, to expand the frame. And I'm very happy to be part of that. And I'm very happy to have our church be part of that. And I'm very happy to introduce the special guest, Dave Zirin, who is going to moderate and MC the event. Known Dave for a while, not well enough, but enough to know that he's a remarkable person. He's one of the most brilliant journalists of our time, specialty of sports, of course, but as you should know, he writes a column in the Nation magazine on the politics of sports. He has a program, the Sirius XM Radio weekly. It's called The Edge of Sports, if I'm not mistaken. And his latest book is called Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. And he's even recognized by the reader as one of the 50 visionaries changing our world. So, we're really happy to have Dave here. And Dave is going to pick up the thread of this program now.
Years of reading Joel to actually meet him is a thrill unto itself and worth the 20-block trek in the snow when the train broke down on 103rd Street to get here. So thank you so much, Joel. It is such a tremendous honor to moderate this event and stand in solidarity with causes that I believe in so strongly Although I should warn you from the outset, to quote the great historian Howard Zinn, you really could not have found a less moderate moderator to be up here when it comes to how I feel about these different causes. And when I was talking with Joel beforehand, one of the first things that Joel said to me after being so warm and inviting was to say, "So, why did they ask you to moderate this thing?" And I was like, "Yeah, what must that meeting have been like with Adala, where they said, okay, we're going to be talking about Palestinian, Native American, and African American liberation and self-determination. Is there a Jewish sports writer we can find to represent this? Get me the list of Jewish sports writers. That will make this complete." But I really am glad that the whole Jewish sports writer identity thing is being represented up here today as a part of this, partly because we need our own liberation and self-determination, but more, not so much the sports writer part, although I do believe very strongly that through the lens of sports, you can tell quite the story about the price of occupation, particularly in Gaza, whether you're talking about the assassination and imprisonment of members of the Palestinian national soccer team, whether you're talking about the targeting of fields of play where young Gaza children go to play different sports, or whether you're just talking about Israel's efforts to eliminate hope, eliminate play, eliminate the childhoods of so many people who live in the occupied territories. But I'm less happy to be here as a sports writer, and more I'm glad to be here as somebody who was born Jewish. I will admit I'm not currently licensed as a Jew, but I was born and raised Jewish, bar mitzvah. I've got the scars to prove it. And I'm glad to be here as a Jew for two reasons. The first is that I would argue that one of the crimes of Zionism, it's certainly not at the top of the list of crimes, but one of the crimes, is taking the tradition in the Jewish community and in Jewish culture of standing on the side of the oppressed and standing on the side of people fighting for self-determination and destroying that history or warping it beyond all possible recognition. So for that reason, I'm happy to be here to lay claim to the fact that there is a tradition in the Jewish community that stands against everything that Zionism stands for. That's the first thing. And the second reason I'm glad to be here is that, you know, most Jews in this country did not vote for Mitt Romney. Most Jews in this country do not stand with Michelle Bachmann, Rick Santorum, and all the ghouls on the far right. They tend to still be liberal politically, and I would venture to say that most Jews in the United States would stand with two of the three struggles on this platform today. They would stand with the cause of Native Americans. They would stand with the cause of African Americans. But they would not stand with the Palestinian cause. Far too many Jews are in what I call the PEP squad, which stands for progressive, except for Palestine. And it's about time for the PEP squad to disband. I consider myself very proudly to be a Jewish anti-Zionist, or JAZ, as we call ourselves. So, the call to the Jewish community is, it's time to leave the PEP squad and join the jazz band. So, for the very simple reason that if racism and oppression are wrong in one part of the world, it's wrong everywhere in the world. You cannot pick and choose and say some apartheid is okay and some is not. But hey, enough of my yakking. Let's get to our first speaker. Our first speaker was a member of the Black Panther Party for 10 years. In 1968, he co-founded the first chapter of the Black Panther Party outside of the state of California. He's the author of the brilliant book, my favorite book from last year. It's called My People Are Rising, Memoir of a Black Panther Captain. He's also the founder of Central House, a nonprofit that provides housing and leadership development for youth, and he has co-founded several other community nonprofits. In 2006, he ran a brilliant campaign for U.S. Senate on the Green Party ticket in the state of Washington. And this past October, he traveled to Palestine as a member of the African American Heritage Delegation. It's my honor to bring to the stage Mr. Aaron Dixon.
Thank you. stand here, but
my grandmother always used to tell me I was going to be a minister, but it never turned out right. That's the right stand. But I'm really glad to be here. We're long overdue talking about and building this solidarity that we need to have against the oppressed people in this country, Native Americans and African Americans. And I would also add Latinos in this country, along with Palestinians. I'm just amazed that we haven't began to build this solidarity movement sooner. It's long overdue. But this wasn't always the case. As a member of the Black Panther Party in 1968, when we began to arm ourselves against the oppression by the police forces in this country, and all of the assassinations had been taking place, we decided that we were going to arm ourselves and protect ourselves. Around that same time in 1968, the PLO began to arm themselves and form a guerrilla movement. And I remember being in the Black Panther Party in our international section of our newspaper. We always carried articles about all of the struggles that were taking place all over the world. And we always really paid a lot of attention and featured a lot of articles that had to do with the PLO struggle. So we followed the PLO struggle on a daily basis. And in 1971, at our international section in Algeria, Yasser Arafat visited the compound and met with Eldridge Cleaver and Don Costa, Field Marshal of the Black Panther Party. And in fact, Don Costa, Field Marshal of the BPP at that time, also visited many of the PLO training camps at that time. I recently had an opportunity to travel to Palestine. I was aware somewhat of the oppression that was taking place against the Palestinian people, but when I got there and observed it for myself, I was shocked. I didn't know how to take it. I didn't know how to deal with it from what I saw. But after observing it for a few days, what really struck me was a comparison of what was happening to the Palestinian people and what was happening to Black people and Native American people in this country. You know, the militarization of the police department in this country. The Israeli soldiers everywhere we went, you know, 5 and 6 and 7 Israeli soldiers with machine guns, with M16, American M16 and Uzis, with their fingers on the trigger, walking everywhere and stopping Palestinian men and frisking them and searching them. Just like they do here in New York, just like they do in LA, just like they do in so many cities of America, stopping and frisking young Black men, young Latino men, and searching them, asking for them for their IDs. The same thing, the building of barriers and separating communities and displacing families and displacing whole communities. I saw that in Palestine, and of course we know that is happening here on a daily basis. I had an opportunity on our travels through Palestine. One of the things that we were asked to do was to meet with a settler, a Israeli settler, who was from Brooklyn, and who was packing a 9mm Glock. And I, myself, and another African American young lady from Chicago, we asked him if he would take his gun off, and he said no, and we refused to meet with him. So the other delegation went inside, and the young lady and I stayed outside and waited. And while we were waiting, we watched these Israeli soldiers walking around with their machine guns and continually questioning Palestinian men. And this young lady began to tell me a story that really let me know that there is such a great comparison of what's going on here in America, what's taking place in Palestine. She told me of a story that her and a young white lady, who was a colleague of hers, went to the west side of Chicago, where this young lady lives, the African-American lady lives, and they were stopped by an Arab policeman and a Mexican policeman. Mm-hmm. and they were questioned, brutally questioned, and they're asked for their ID. They were strip searched, and there were some kids that were playing on the side, and they recognized this African American girl, and they began to throw rocks at the policemen, just as young Palestinian kids throw rocks at the Israeli soldiers. And they were wondering why this white girl is with this black girl in a black community, which you see the same thing happening in Palestine. And they eventually were both arrested and taken down and charged with whatever, I believe, I don't know. But as I continued to travel around Palestine and observe things, what was going on, observing families losing their homes. We met with one family who had been fighting to hold on to their house for 10 years, and luckily they had the papers to be able to, you know, make this fight. But they told us about the people across the street, the Palestinian family that had lived across the street, and how the Israeli soldiers came at 4 in the morning, heavily armed, and moved this family out on the street and threw all their belongings out on the street and moved a settler family into their house. And how their 89-year-old grandmother, who had protested against the Israeli occupation, had been arrested and arrested over 6 times and actually hospitalized because she had been brutalized. There are so many things that we saw, so many things. We went to the village of Belen, where the 5 broken cameras was made. And I remember seeing that film before I took that trip. And I remember the young boy who the film was centered around. And I was just amazed to be able to see this young man. But when we got there, they immediately took us down to where they had the weekly protests. And we could smell the gas, the tear gas. We could smell the skunk oil that had been sprayed on the Palestinian demonstrators. They showed us the olive trees that had been burned down by settlers. They also showed us a grove of 1,000 olive trees that had been completely cut off. And when we saw the wall, we saw this huge wall. Everywhere we went, we saw this wall that had separated communities. And we learned that the wall was really about taking control of the water that belonged to the Palestinian people. And the Palestinian people have to have water towers on their homes. That's how you could tell where a Palestinian home was as opposed to an Israeli home, because they had water towers where they were allocated a certain amount of water. And so, you know, the denial of access to water, the denial of access to being able to build their communities economically, the displacement, all of these things were so familiar. But one of the things that was really familiar but was really even more profane was the white privilege that we saw. Now we as black people, we deal with white privilege all the time and we see it all the time. But to see it in the occupied territories was disturbing, where Palestinians are not respected at all. They have no rights whatsoever. And so this comparison really hit home. And I really decided when I got back to Seattle, when I got back to wherever I was coming back in the U.S., I was going to work to educate black people and others about what was taking place and why we have to build this solidarity movement. Because the same government that oppresses the Palestinian people is the same government that oppresses black people, Native American people, and Latin American people here in this country. We provide the financial support, we provide the military support for the Israeli government. In return, Israeli government has trained police departments here in this country. They trained the Oakland Police Department in Oakland. And the same neo-economic policies that we have in this country is the same neo-economic conservative policies that they have in Israel. And it's quite obvious that it's not sustainable in Israel. And it's not going to be sustainable in this country because we're destroying the environment, just as it is destroying the environment in Israel. So I'm hoping that this will be the beginning. This will be the beginning of something new. This will be the beginning of a new movement, because there already is a worldwide uprising of poor people all over the world, in China, in India, in Europe, in many places. People are tired. The poor people of the world are tired of the corporations taking over. And that's all it's about. It's about economics. It's about the corporations taking over and the greed. And so we got to come together and bring it to an end. And this is the beginning. Thank you.
One more time for Aaron Dixon. I can't play. Good morning. Oh, it's okay. I did want to let folks know that Adala, they have a sign-up sheet in the back, and my interaction with them has been just incredibly positive, a remarkable group of activists. People should sign up in the back if they want more information about their activities. But first, I introduce the next speaker. Oh, wait, performance now. My bad. Just took your talk.
When the south of the country was being occupied by the Israeli army. And you could, just like Fez and with Fez in 1980, you could from the capital hear the bombs ringing down from your bedroom window, even though it was in the south. It's a really small country. And so, you know, something like that at first, it inspires grief, it inspires horror, but when it eventually just becomes a nightly soundtrack, you just kind of get used to it. And you also are very grateful that, you know, even though these horrendous things are happening within earshot, that you yourself at least are safe. So to begin the musical performances, first we're going to have our cellist Gabriel Dresdale play an ode to an olive tree, followed by the song that I spoke about with the same title as the poem, Lullaby to a Palestinian Child. And I'm really sorry that I had trouble having you guys here. Okay.
Thank you.
Boy, I'd hate to follow that. Our next speaker. Just kidding. Okay. Our next speaker is a Diné entrepreneur who moved back to Diné-ta, sacred homeland of her people located in the southwestern United States, to work in sustainable community development. With climate change increasing drought conditions, the Diné people face the need to build resilient communities. This task requires community-led resistance to the continued economic exploitation championed by fossil fuel industries and the state, federal, and Navajo Nation governmental policies that support them. Her business, Six World Solutions, seeks to implement sustainable economic, social, and environmental justice projects developed through a framework of human rights and community empowerment. I'm so proud to introduce Janine Yazzie.
Wow, this is a little strange, and now I get a full view of how many people are here. Woo! Thank you for that introduction. Yate, she Janine Yazzie and she. It's a pleasure to be here today, especially considering the people that I have the honor to speak with up here. But to begin with, and this is a little weird considering the setup, but when I was thinking about this, I wasn't thinking about the context. But I did sincerely want to do this. So can I ask you to please close your eyes, everybody? And I want you to feel what I have to say. And that is, thank you. Thank you for your struggles, for the paths that you guys have chosen, for the resistance that you make, for the pain that you carry. Thank you. It is not an easy path. It is filled with many people who will break you down or overwhelm you with the challenges that they place in front of you. It is filled with long hours of work, of going without pay, of working your body tirelessly, of straining your mind trying to think of solutions. And it brings many tears. But thank you for shedding those tears and for choosing that path anyway. Because in that choice, you make your connection to this time, this place, this world, that much stronger. Thank you for choosing this time to live. Okay, you can open your eyes now. As activists and as people who resist, I don't think we thank ourselves enough. I don't think we greet ourselves or each other with gratitude for all the struggles that we carry, the work that we do. And so I want to make that a habit. When I wrote my editorial on my President Ben Shelley of the Navajo Nation, taking a visit to Israel to study agricultural projects, it was written in a private email to a friend of mine who loved it so much he decided to send it to media outlets, and I didn't find out until my inbox was flooded with hate mail. And with people standing up for Israel from all nations, even Native American Jews that I didn't know existed, trying to persuade me that I was wrong. And their arguments were very interesting, to say the least. The way people justify their positions and accepting being part of systems of oppression. But underlying all of those emails was this message that of divine right, of God-ordained privilege to carry out these acts of oppression. And all that kept, you know, especially when this came from, you know, the Lakota Dene Jews that were writing to me, I could not believe that they could not hear the similarities between the doctrine of discovery and manifest destiny and make the connection with the pain and continued colonization and genocide that's being carried out against our own peoples within the great United States. It's this rhetoric, this religious rhetoric, that has helped establish the three pillars of white supremacy as articulated by Andrea Smith. How many have you, read the recommended reading? Okay, that's a few hands. Okay, the three pillars of white supremacy, which are basically one, to establish a slave race, two, to eradicate, commit genocide against the indigenous peoples, and three, to establish a sense of nationality under the threat, the premise that everyone that is other raises a threat. These three pillars are, I'm sure most of you understand, the foundation of American democracy and American exceptionalism that allows us to continue to champion globalization and capitalism around the world under the premise that we are spreading progress and goodness and all those great things. It's exemplified in Cornell's recent partnership with the Technion University out of Israel, which is developing a research and development university here in Manhattan. And for those of you who don't know about Technion, they are one of the places where they've been dreaming of the marvelous military inventions that require less manpower to continue the oppression and removal of Palestinians. This capitalization, the system of capitalization, is what we all hold in common across our struggles. It's what's exploiting all our peoples and our lands and resources. And in the time of climate change and depleting resources and overconsumption of precious minerals such as water, this is what's creating the biggest threat for our children. Our babies. I'm a mother, so I get very sentimental when I talk about this part. It's a travesty and a system of power that is normalized through our education systems everywhere. We're all at war, and our children are the ones that are being the most targeted, the most victimized, and put at the most disadvantage. I was asked to come here to speak to how can we build solidarity across all our struggles, and that's a very complex question because in our struggles there's a lot of complex nuances that deserve addressing. I mean, one of the things we try to do is bring voice to and educate people about settler colonialism, and that's been the most difficult when speaking to my own people and my own communities, let alone going around country talking to people about settler colonialism and decolonization. There's been a corporatization of our education systems. And for my people, that history is very clear in the legacy of boarding schools and the violence that it committed and the way that it broke up our families and our communities. And we're still living with that legacy today. Many of those boarding schools still exist. They're still the primary centers of education for our children. And although we try to talk about how, you know, it's progressed, they no longer use corporate punishment, the end goal is the same. The end goal is the same in all our education systems. And that's to eradicate understanding of the spirit from our children. And so what do we do if we're going to build solidarity across our struggles? I say we teach them a new rhetoric. We stop teaching them this idea that the paradigm exists as a us versus them construction, because then we're just appropriating the same systems that our oppressors have implemented for us. We need to teach them to think, speak, and act beyond that. And in my work, with what I do in my community, even though it's a for-profit business, it's I like to talk about how I made a business out of being, starting a revolution of the mind and the spirit, and it makes me feel better about the tedious process of running a business. But in the work that we do, we try to reconnect communities through their children back to the earth, to understanding where their food comes from, to understanding where their meat comes from, where their water comes from, and why it's important to understand the ecological processes that good, healthy, nutritious foods and resources depend upon. And in just doing that simple act, you do invite that education of the spirit, because children understand. They see a lot easier than adults do, because we've been so conditioned and so cut off from our food sources. It's so easy to just go to the store and pick up what we need that we don't appreciate what it takes to actually grow and communicate with plants, to actually look into the eyes of an animal when you kill it and appreciate its sacrifice and what it's giving you. And when you establish that communication with the youth, it changes their minds, changes the way they see the world around them, and in turn, changes the way they see themselves. And, you know, in doing my work, obviously, I end up doing a lot of activism in the traditional sense, because our politicians are always up to something, and I'm sure you all know what that's like. And I realize that that understanding gets lost a lot in the strategizing and organizing that we do. That ability to focus on the youth, to remember what we're doing this for, why we're resisting, and to bring them into these dialogues and invite them to these spaces and carving out a place that they can call their own in the midst of these conversations. And that's something that we should do all the time. And so I'm very honored to be here today to speak and to learn from people who are representing struggles that are different from mine, but that hold something in common. But if we are to move forward, and if we are to be successful, we need to realize that we're butting heads when we're trying to change the mindsets of those who profit and benefit from these systems of power. But that in just focusing on that, we're losing the chance and the opportunity to change the minds of those who are going to inherit those systems and be more capable of changing and transforming them. And now more than ever, we need to start fighting for that. Because if we gain our freedom tomorrow, if the systems of destruction fall, if the systems of oppression fall today, we need to be able to survive and provide for ourselves, feed ourselves, and create prosperity for our families. And we can't do that if all we're doing is appropriating the rhetoric and the tactics of our oppressors. They would like that. What they're unprepared for is us transforming the game. And we'll do that through our children. Thank you.
As Kimberly and Farrah come to the stage for their performance, I just wanted to let people know that there should be a hat that's either being passed or is about to be passed around. There we go. We have a hat volunteer. Thank you, sir. And people might not know this, but Janine, my goodness, Janine came here from Arizona. She flew here. She flew here just for this event from Arizona. So we're passing the hat. Yeah, that gets a round of applause. Flying. That's a quite a commute. So we want to be able to help a ballot defray those travel costs, not to mention the costs that go to putting on an event like this. So please give if you can when the hat reaches you. Thank you.
Hey, how are you guys? My name is Courtney Rose. Which way should I turn? Okay. My name is Courtney Rose. I am absolutely, absolutely honored to be here at this amazing, amazing event. I'm a percussionist, Ben Larson and Farrah Burns. Ben will be on piano, Farrah will be on clarinet. But we're all about bridging the gap. And like I said, I'm absolutely honored to be here. Ben actually called me and was like, hey, Courtney, I hope you don't mind doing this thing I got going on. So once I heard what was the cause, I was like, yeah, sure, Ben, I'll do it, no problem. But when he asked me to speak in front of you guys, I said, okay, man, you're pushing. But I'm absolutely honored to be here, and we're just going to do a little piece for you called Bridging the Gap. Thank you so much.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. How are you guys doing today? I love the energy in here, and this piece is a heartfelt letter to the world, and I think what better place to do it than here today. Completely off of this, Courtney and I.
got egos, can't see folks, he just tried to give me a dap. If you're listening right now, put your cell phones down. Look over your shoulder, whoever's sitting next to you, give him a hug right now. Tomorrow may never come. Run away, go ahead and give your brother some. Cause tonight we ain't even here by ourselves. We leave it here as one.
A founding member of Adala New York, the New York Campaign for the Boycott of Israel, and PACB, which stands for the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. So proud to introduce Riham Barghouti.
Our co-sponsor, Scientific Soul Sessions, my co-panelists, Aaron and Janine, and really my colleagues at Adala New York for putting together this great event with these amazing performances. I think it's a fitting end to an inspiring week of activism on the discussion on Palestine and BDS. So I want to thank everybody for also coming out in this morning. Now, there's no doubt that the Palestinian struggle is connected with other struggles for peace, justice, equality, and rights. Parallels can be drawn between apartheid Israel and apartheid South Africa. Segregation between Israeli settlers and Palestinians is remnant of the not-so-distant reality of the Jim Crow laws. Mass incarceration, economic inequality, and the ghettoization of Palestinians is not dissimilar from the realities faced by African Americans, Latino Latinas, Native Americans, and other marginalized groups here today. And the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948, could only evoke the devastating treatment of Native Americans and First Nations in the Americas. So tonight, at the very least, we should acknowledge that our presence here is a result of that colonization process, the colonization of this land, the dispossession of its indigenous people, and we have to give thanks to the Native Americans on whose land we are now standing as we attempt to explore the connections between our struggles. In 1948, the State of Israel was established on 55% of the land. Over the ruins of 500 destroyed villages, and with the expulsion of 750,000 of the indigenous people who, along with their descendants, today live as refugees. The colonization process continues with the occupation and annexation of the remaining 45% of the land, the building of Jewish-only colonies that today house 500,000 settlers, a number the Israeli government plans to double. Roads and buses and other services are provided solely for these Jewish settlers. And in response to recent protests by Palestinians against segregated buses, the Israeli Transportation Ministry has graciously established Palestinian-only buses for workers wanting to go from the West Bank to Israel. The colonization process continues with the construction of a massive apartheid wall that cuts off Palestinian towns from one another and farmers from their land. And Palestinians who resist the wall are detained, arrested, injured, or killed. The colonization process continues with 100,000 Palestinians living in unrecognized villages inside Israel, like Arab al-Khawalid near Yafa or al-Arqib in al-Naqab. They have no access to running water, health and education services, sanitation, or electricity because they don't exist. And as for the recognized Palestinians, the 1.2 million citizens of the State of Israel, the very definition of Israel as a Jewish state makes inequality and discrimination against these non-Jews inevitable. They are deprived access to the use of the land, they face discrimination in employment, education, and housing, and they live under a constant threat of transfer. Of the most basic civil liberties, while the Israeli law of return allows any Jew to get automatic citizenship in Israel for themselves, their spouses, their children, and their children's spouses, Palestinians are prohibited from bringing non-citizen, read, non-Jewish, spouses to live with them in Israel. The colonization process continues with the detention of 800,000 Palestinian political prisoners since 1967. Today, they number 4,812, including 219 children and 12 women, and 178 administrative detainees who, like my uncle, Ahmed Qatamish, are being detained without charge or trial. For many, like Samir Asawi, their only recourse is to go on hunger strike, while others, like Arafat Jaradat, who at 30 years old died not of a heart attack, but of 6 broken bones to his neck, spine, arms, and legs, are tortured to death during interrogation. The colonization process continues with the demolition of over 28,000 Palestinian homes and businesses since 1967. And tonight, we remember and we honor Rachel Corrie, who died 10 years ago today. She paid with her life when she attempted to stop a Caterpillar bulldozer from demolishing yet another Palestinian home. The colonization process continues with the brutal attacks that have killed thousands and injured tens of thousands of Palestinians. From the refugee camps in Beirut to Jenin, Hebron, Ramallah, Nablus, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, and Gaza. In November 2012, Israel launched yet another attack on Gaza, which killed 166 and injured thousands. It came less than 4 years after the brutal attack of the 2008-2009. And despite the scathing reports by the UN fact-finding mission, Amnesty International, the Red Cross, Human Rights Watch, and others of the clear violations of war, there were no consequences to Israel's actions, and therefore no need for Israel to curb its colonization process. Now, between Israel and Palestine, the imbalance of power is glaringly clear. And it's not because you have on the one side the fourth largest army in the world. What makes the imbalance so great is that Israel enjoys unmitigated economic, political, and diplomatic support from the United States, from Canada, the European nations, and their lackeys in the developing world. Companies in these countries provide weapons, surveillance equipment, machinery, and technology to maintain the systems of oppression used by Israel against the Palestinians. These countries also utilize Israeli weapons and technology to maintain their own systems of repression and oppression at home. As reported by the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network study on Israel's worldwide role in repression, Israel helps maintain, quote, limitations on the freedom of movement, the policing of communities, and the undermining of people's struggles for justice around the world. These countries provide markets for Israeli products that support its economy. They provide venues for its artistic groups and joint projects with its academic institutions, all of which enable Israel to interact within the global community in an exalted status in which it can violate international law with no repercussions, in which it can perpetuate the daily violence against Palestinians with no accountability, in which it can continue undeterred in its colonization process. In January, Israel became the first country ever to withhold cooperation from the United Nations Human Rights Council Periodic Review, all 193 member states participate. Now, the reason for Israel's boycott of the UN review was a report issued by the Council which stated, quote, Israel must in compliance with the Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention cease all settlement activities. The report went on to call on private companies to, quote, take all necessary steps to end their own complicity, and it called on member states to take the appropriate measures to ensure that the companies comply. Now, not only did this report indicate a willingness by the United Nations to hold Israel accountable for its violations of international law, it indicated a recognition by the global body that international companies and their governments must end their own complicity through divestment and sanctions. Further, 7 of the 10 recommendations made in the 2012 report by European representatives to the BPA called on the European Union member states to impose direct or indirect divestment and sanctions on bodies and organizations involved in the construction of settlements. And in December 2012, the ANC, the ruling party in South Africa, made the historic decision to make the Palestinian call for BDS against Israel part of its official policy. These developments are but one indication of the growth of the current movement for BDS against Israel, launched in 2005 with a call by over 170 Palestinian civil society organizations. People of conscience around the world responded to the call to carry out cultural, academic, and sports boycotts, economic boycotts and divestment initiatives, and calls for sanctions against Israel until it ended its colonization of all Arab land, ended its policy of racial discrimination against Palestinians living inside Israel, and upheld the UN-sanctioned Palestinian refugees' right to return. With support from the BNC, the Palestinian BDS National Committee, which provides ethical guidelines and coordination for the movement, today, hundreds of reports, websites, YouTube videos, songs, dances, protests, tweets, blogs, newspaper articles, all document the creative, courageous, and diverse range of BDS initiatives taking place around the world. And to review but a few, cultural boycott continues to grow with Cat Powers, Cassandra Wilson, Dervish, Stevie Wonders, and Alice Walker all upholding the call in 2012. Israeli groups like Bacheva and the Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra's performances are met with protests hindering Brand Israel, a strategy aimed at whitewashing Israeli crimes through art and culture. And in addition to Adana New York's 11 product flyer, which you can get at one of the back tables and which will be passed around shortly, I guess, Adana New York has been working on cultural boycott. We put out a document about providing further information about cultural boycott, and we're soon to launch a new project inviting local cultural workers to voice their support of BDS. And of course, we welcome all the cultural workers that were here today to help us with this project. Here in New York, through efforts of a number of local and international and national organizations, including Brooklyn for Peace, the Park Slope Food Co-op Boycott, Jews Say No, Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, Artists Against Apartheid, ISO, Women in Black, Westpac Foundation, and the work of the SJPs at Columbia, CUNY, and NYU, BDS is flourishing. The academic boycott initiative was launched by New Yorkers Against Cornell Technion Partnership to respond to the Cornell Technion Partnership that Janine mentioned earlier. Through meetings with Roosevelt Island residents, articles in newspapers, and bi-monthly reports, protests at the Google building in Chelsea, which are taking place now every other Tuesday, NIAC is helping to raise awareness of Technion's complicity in Israel's violations and its connection with the Israeli military-industrial complex. Nationally, campus activism is on the rise, with UC Irvine, UC Berkeley, Arizona, UMass Boston student groups all passing resolutions in 2012. And this year, while a divestment measure failed at Stanford University, within days, UC Riverside and UC San Diego student governments passed divestment resolutions. Now, an interesting phenomenon that is taking place around much of the BDS work in the US is that it's coalescing around specific target companies that are implicated in the largest divestment initiatives we have currently taking place, which is the We Divest campaign. We Divest, launched by JVP in 2010, is now coordinated by a coalition of organizations, including Adela New York, the US campaign, the American Friends Service Committee, and Grassroots International. The campaign is directed at the pension fund giant, TIAA Craft, investments in Caterpillar, Veolia, Hewlett-Packard, Motorola, G4S, and SodaStream. Student and local groups are either joining the TIAA Craft campaign or carrying out parallel boycott and divestment initiatives against one of the target companies. And these campaigns are beginning to feel the BDS pinch. In 2012, Caterpillar was downgraded by Morgan Stanley Index of Social Responsible Investment, which led TIAA Craft to divest from Caterpillar from its SRI fund. And this was accompanied by the Quakers, Friends Fiduciary Corporation, divesting its Caterpillars its holdings in Caterpillar, and it also divested in Hewlett-Packard and Veolia. Now, Veolia is a French multinational company that has lost billions of dollars in contracts due to BDS organizing internationally. It was named in a shareholders' resolution just recently filed in February by over 200 Craft clients calling for the fund to divest from all companies profiting from the occupation. And at the same time, activists in Northern California and St. Louis have attracted wide-based support by highlighting Veolia's bad business practices, not just in Palestine, but in the US as well, to stop their cities from contracting the company. Another campaign bursting Israel's bubble is SodaStream, the newest target of a campaign by Code Pink, which is the organization that made BDS sexy with their campaign against the Hama. SodaStream has also become the target of the first ever interfaith-based BDS initiative. And the campaign includes the Presbyterian and the United Methodist Church, both of which passed resolutions last year to boycott settlement products. Now, all this is not to say that there aren't challenges and attacks being made against this movement. I think a particularly racist claim being made, for example, is that boycott somehow hurts Palestinians more than colonization does. This claim is being countered by Palestinians on the ground. For example, last month, a call by Palestinian farmers' organizations to end the trade with Israeli agricultural companies highlighted how these companies use stolen land and water, profit from the siege of Gaza, and profit from the destruction of Palestinian agriculture. But I think the most spurious of attacks against BDS is it is anti-Semitic. And it's been said, and it's been written, but I will repeat it. It is disingenuous to conflate the valid criticisms of Israel with the hate crime of anti-Semitism. From the onset, the BDS movement has categorically and consistently rejected all forms of racism. Further, it has invited conscientious Israelis and Jews to be a part of the movement, and the movement salutes the work of JVP and IJAN and Boycott From Within and the Coalition of Women for Peace and others, all of whom reject the anti-Semitic claim made by Israel and its lobby that they represent all Jews. These arguments against BDS are not new. But what is new, I think, is that they are increasingly being made in mainstream arenas. We are discussing BDS in the New York Times and the Daily News and the St. Louis and the New York City Councils and in TIAA shareholders meeting and Sunday morning talk shows. and in churches, general assemblies, and in university administrations, and in the United Nations, and increasingly with government agencies. And as we enter the mainstream, attempts to delegitimize and illegalize the movement are going to increase. As we can see from Israel's anti-boycott law, recent events at Brooklyn College, the struggle at the LGBT Center, and the attacks against the Park Slope Food Co-op boycott. But this should only serve to galvanize us, because it means that they are not ignoring us or laughing at us. They are attacking us, and we all know what happens next. So in closing, I want to share a personal note, even though I'm a little over time. Growing up in the US was challenging. In the 70s and 80s, the very existence of a Palestinian people was denied. But I knew we existed. I knew it in the food that I ate, in the songs that I sang, in the debkeh that I danced. I knew it in my aunt's olive groves and my grandmother's stories, and in the faces of little boys throwing rocks at big tanks. But every time someone asked me, either out of ignorance, curiosity, or cruelty, where Palestine was on the map, I faltered. I so internalized the question of my very existence that I would check for Palestine on every map or globe I could find, always to be disappointed. Until I got to Brooklyn Technical High School, where there was an old globe in the library that had, between Egypt, Jordan, and Lebanon, the name Palestine. The globe is still there. I saw it recently when I was invited to do a BDS presentation at Tech. It's still there, and we are still here. And during my numerous visits to Palestine, and during the time I lived there, I found that not only do we exist, but we are vibrant, strong, and steadfast people. Palestine and Palestinians exist, Native Americans and First Nations exist, African Americans exist, and it is this. It is our collective existence. It is our insistence to not only exist, but exist as equal human beings. It's our refusal to be silenced, or erased, or extinguished, or broken. It is our hold on our own humanity in the face of oppression, colonialism, and racism. Ultimately, this is our greatest resistance. And this is where I get my hope and my strength, and this is why I no longer look on colonial maps to see if Palestine is there, for I know, and they know, we exist.
talk too much, but I just made a side note. I was thinking that as I was watching, you know, what's going on. And just on a personal note, I guess it's a reason. I always seem to, at different times, run into Palestinian people when I need their help, and they've come through to help me. When I first moved to New York, I had an apartment that had a television that didn't work, and there was a television shop right around the corner run by some Palestinians. They brought and said, yeah, we can fix it. They fixed it, and the first thing I turned on after not watching television for about a year was, I'm from Connecticut, Quantucket, and the first thing I saw was an anti-Klan rally where the Ku Klux Klan leader was speaking just before our 2x4, and a crowd of people just rushed up to the big thing. But anyway, there's other stories too, but I won't bore you with that. I'm just going to play some music right now. I'm going to start out with a song that I wrote called Phrygia. And I don't really like to use the word global warming. These are the time of purification that we've been taught, but this is just Phrygia because it's cold like that.
Thank you.
Sonny Stone. That story of my life. But this one is when I wrote. Years ago. This next one is it's called Slipping Into the Beak of Time. Song, American Indian Movement song. And, this is played.
Sloan. Long time ago at the 25th anniversary of AIM back in St. Paul, Minnesota. But this song, I'm going to ask you to stand, so could everyone please stand, because this song is dedicated to fighting terrorism since 1492. All those warriors.
Yeah, I'll go first.
What has recently given me strength is when I went to Palestine and observed the occupation. After the first couple of days that I was there, I was extremely angry. And a little bit in despair. Until I got a chance to spend time with the Palestinian activists and spend time in the homes of the Palestinians. And what I observed was, you know, we stayed at their homes, and at night they wanted to drink and party and have a good time. They wanted to stay up all night. They were so joyous, so happy. And what occurred to me was that they had decided that struggle was part of their life, but they were also going to enjoy life and be happy. And there was no sense of despair in them. And I heard over and over again that we're going to win this. They were very confident that they were going to be victorious in the end. And they understood that Israel, what they were doing was not sustainable. And they didn't want pity from anybody, didn't want anybody to feel sorry for them. They knew that this was their life and they were going to continue to struggle. And that gave me hope. That made me feel stronger. That yes, that we can be victorious, and that this is a long struggle, but this is what we have to do. And they imparted their strength into me, and that's most recently has given me a lot of hope.
A lot of things give me hope, I think. Just like a lot of things sadden and disappoint me and dishearten me. But recently I went to Puerto Rico to a human rights conference. And I found there, you know, a group of people that were working on Puerto Rican independence. And I was so moved by the work that they were doing. And they were honoring political prisoners that were here in the U.S. that were being held for, you know, over 30 years. And it was just such an eye-opening experience, because there are struggles happening in so many places that we may not be aware of. There are people that are really committed to morally ethical things that are right and are just, and they're working to change the systems. And I think that what we miss out sometimes is we're so focused on our own movements. I was just in Toronto last week with a speaker from the Beaver Creek Nation that was working on getting indigenous people's rights there and making the Canadian government uphold the treaties that were signed. And there's work being carried out in so many different places on so many levels. So I think that I have hope, and there's a lot of things, a lot of struggles that I'm not even aware of that are happening that ultimately are going to make the Palestinian struggle and other struggles for justice come about.
I think there's a lot of things that give us hope, and the things that we do and the people we encounter on the paths that we're on. But when you asked that question, the main thing that popped into my mind is women. Women give me hope. Women, because whether they're sisters, mothers, daughters, aunts, they have the ability to carry a universal message of love that can be understood and that's embraced by the men who protect them. And whatever society, whatever community, whatever nationality that we are in, those women and those men are the ones that are at the forefront of struggle and change, and that have the strength to take up these challenges. And when I meet these people, it makes everything so much more worth it, because you recognize your human community.
And I'll just throw out there on the whole point that yesterday, where I live in the great state of Maryland, we repealed the death penalty. The first state south of the Mason-Dixon line to repeal the death penalty in the history of the United States. And so any questions from any of the folks here? Right there. A mic is coming to you. And if you could say your name, please.
Name is Judy Solomon. This is a wonderful panel and evening and entertaining. Thank you.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to know, a year or two ago I heard that there was some project that brought young Native Americans to Palestine. I don't remember who, maybe somebody here knows about it. And I was wondering if there was more of that going on. Do you remember that? A little. Becky Thompson. I don't know if you have. Well, throwing the question out there and also asking the panelists if they think they need to work on connection or specifically and help us all to that or whatever.
Knowledge of that connection?
I don't have any knowledge of that. It would be interesting to have such a project, I think, and I think it's essential for both Palestinians and for Native Americans to understand again that there are people that are having very similar struggles so far away, especially for children and for youth to understand that. So if it's not going on, it should be going on. Maybe somebody can start working on it. The other part of the question was about, oh, definitely, cross-building solidarity. I think at the very least, the first level is awareness and understanding and making those connections, because we know that it's the same forces, whether it's companies or it's governments, that are oppressing us. So if we're not connecting with each other to remove that, we're not going to be able to do it individually. And it's even within our own communities, it's when we find, as Palestinians, African Americans, Jewish Americans, Native Americans, Asian Americans, so on and so forth, we can all collectively work much better than we can individually, because we have the same struggles. It's Elbit that's building walls in Palestine and between the US and Mexico. It's that Caterpillar that is demolishing homes, but also demolishing in Palestine, but also demolishing areas here and helping to gentrify areas. It is these same companies. You know, Northrop Grumman is an evil worldwide. So we definitely have to start, building solidarity and working together and understanding each other's struggles.
Working off of her response, I think that strategy is the root of decolonization and transforming educational experiences for our youth and young leaders around the world. And it should be something that is planned and incorporated in every activist group organization strategy for how to combat these powers. When we create programs like that, for my people especially, I think something like that would be revolutionary and phenomenal because of how much the military successfully recruits people from my reservation, because we're raised with this mentality that there's no other option. But if you're sending kids on missions of peace and of community building and of hope and possibility, and they create projects or they work with communities on something meaningful, that transforms their lives and their minds. And I think it needs to be a vital component of everything that we start to do from this point forward.
And who knew we had a Lakota Jewish competition for the hearts and minds of Native American youth. So that is work that needs to be done.
It's vitally important for us to build broad-based coalitions, and that was one of the things that the Black Panther Party mastered. We had broad coalition building, and that's what made us so effective, and that's what made us so dangerous. And we had coalitions with the Red Guard, the Brown Brigade, Brown Berets, AIM, Peace and Freedom Party. We had support organizations all over the world, and we used to say, brown power to brown people, red power to red people, white power to white people, black power to black people, yellow power to yellow people, all power to the people. And I always like to use this analogy as my hands. As I spread my hands like this, all my fingers are vulnerable, but when it's united into a fist, that is unity. And that is power. And that's what we need. That's what we need to defeat this empire. We got to have unity. Because with unity, we have power. All power to the people.
Oh, there is an answer to the question. I'm sorry. It did happen in 2008 or 2009. Indigenous youth delegation to Palestine with the Palestine Education Project, Snag Magazine, etc. There's more information online. Thank you for whoever answered that. Look into Palestine Education Project. It was called the Indigenous Youth Delegation to Palestine. And it was apparently in SWAG or Snag Magazine. Snag.
Next, our question in the back, and then the gentleman over here. Over. That's your first question.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know if you had that simple answer, like, is this a 5-year period?
It took decades. It actually started very similarly to the Palestinian boycott call. It started after the International Court of Justice put out a ruling against the Namibian occupation. And after that, there was concerted efforts, but it really took decades for the South African BDS movement. And our partners and activists in South Africa actually tell us that the Palestinian BDS movement is moving at a quicker pace, especially because of the internet, especially because of the fact that people can have information and share actions and campaigns and all of this. So actually, comparatively speaking, but the South African anti-apartheid movement, including the BDS movement, took decades.
What resonated with me was that what connected your cause is really this idea of whiteness, right? Because the idea of white settler colonialism, the idea of white Israeli state, you know, backed up by this religious rhetoric, the idea of blackness constructed as opposed to whiteness, and as, you know, people of color sitting up there, I would love for you to kind of give us your thoughts on how we can liberate ourselves as people. Just people, not of color, not of white, whatever skin. What it would take for our nation to really overcome this idea of whiteness and the superiority complex that come with it? Because I think a lot of us, irrespective of our color, are struggling with that idea still. And what it would take for that paradigm shift to happen so we can really see each other in the eyes as people, as human beings. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just the response to the whiteness comment, I feel like it's more about, to be honest, European colonialism. If we look at it, whether it's the Zionist movement in Israel or the colonization of this land over here, it's about European colonization, and it's been happening for so long. And I feel like because, you know, what is white and black and Latino? These days, these ethnicities are meaning less and less. It's not just the other that is oppressing us. It's people within our own communities and people within our own societies. that are oppressing each other. So I think for me, it's breaking away from that hierarchy. It's breaking away from this need for power. So when we fight for Palestinian human rights, it's not so that we can now be the people that are dominating or the people that are oppressing or the people that are enslaving. It's about ending that system. So it's ending systems wherever they are. And it takes a long time for us to break away from this, from what we have been taught, how we have been raised. Because everything is about power and money. And whether we're at work, or we're dealing with our children, or we're dealing in our communities, we tend to internalize that kind of dynamic, or that hierarchy that's there. So for me, that's the first step. It's kind of saying, you know, I just want to be equal with you. I don't want to be better, I don't want to be worse. I want to be equal with you, and understanding what that means.
I think, thank you for that question. I think it's a very important question that we need to keep in the forefront of our minds at all times. Because when we start to construct our movements around the dialogue of this us versus them, them being white, we overlook and overshadow the weaknesses in our own organizations and in our own communities and the complexities that do lead, like you said, to our own people oppressing us. I forgot to make this disclaimer when I stood up there, but I feel like a lot of what I spoke did was obviously from my own perspective. But it makes me really uncomfortable when I'm brought to events and people look at me as if I'm a representative of Native America. I'm not even a spokesperson for Navajo people, and let alone an expert on my own community's complexities. And when I'm truthful about being an organizer, I have to admit about the, and be cognizant of, and educate people on the inherent sexism, the inherent superiority complex, and racism that permeates even grassroots organizations on my reservation. And I know it's something that's endemic in all organizing structures, whether we're advocating against extreme energy extraction companies, or whether we're advocating for, you know, the rights of animals, or for the rights of specific frontline communities who are battling their very unique forms of oppression. We need to address these issues. And it's very hard when you're trying to speak this language and make these changes, talking upwards to, you know, people from that are educated under a system of teaching these binary constructions, that, you know, uses this rhetoric to create division in the communities, in the families. And that's why I feel like a lot of the work that we do is now shifting to the children and teaching them a new way of thinking and constructing their understanding about the systems that they've inherited, and understanding their humanness and their relations to people of all nations, to people of all gendered experiences, sexualities, whatever we come to define ourselves, and just understanding us as, Dene in my language, it means the five-fingered holy beings. And I feel like we've lost that understanding of ourselves as divine creatures capable of making small creations, and that's what we need to reinvoke. And that doesn't have a color, it doesn't have a race, an ethnicity, and a particular experience. It's validated across all peoples.
Through our struggle, I think it's important that we have to incorporate healing among our people, among ourselves, because we've had 500-600 years of trauma, and that trauma has been transferred to us from generation to generation to generation. And you can just see it. You know, mental illness has quadrupled in this country in the last 30 years. And this is what this whiteness, this is what this oppression does. It traumatizes us. And it doesn't matter where we go. Every time, you know, when I went to Palestine and saw what was happening and saw that whole white supremacy being played out, even though it wasn't happening to me, I felt it. I felt the trauma that I had felt in the U.S. And so I think that's one of the things that we must do. We have to find ways of healing ourselves and healing our people. As I've traveled through New York and went through Brooklyn and many other places, I see the trauma on the people. I see it, and I feel it. And that is something that we have to start to think about, you know, through meditation or through going to rituals or, you know, I know in the Native American community, they deal with that a lot in terms of dealing with that trauma. And it's very real. And we have to realize that we have to heal.
We're going to take the next three people, 1, 2, 3, and then all in a row, and then our speakers are going to wrap up. So, sir, and then you, sir, over here, and then ma'am, you over there.
Yes, you mentioned the situation with the boycotts, and reminded me, especially talking about that took place in Zambia, also in South Africa. There were situations where you had freedom fighters in this country that did expropriations to support the movement in South Africa. They call them bank robbers here, but we know them as their political prisoners and prisoners of war. So my question is, just looking at the panel, thinking of also Blanco and Bennett Peltier, thinking about the Palestinian political prisoners, and I'm definitely thinking about the Panther political prisoners across the board. Before I even ask the question, I want to acknowledge, after there's two former Panther political prisoners here in the audience, you know, Brother Tyree, and Brother George, the judges will be acknowledged.
We will stand up.
So my question is, if we're talking about unifying the struggle across the board, how can we unify that on an international level to free our political prisoners and prisoners of war in El Capitan?
Terrific. Now, you, sir, right here. It's a terrific question.
Thank you. Linked to the issue for healing, question of governance and non-governance. Now, in the case of Palestine, there has been both government resistance and non-government resistance. And my query is, what did your alliance with non-government resistance launched by peace movements in Israel, in which many Jews are involved and expect their lives? And what is your position on continued violence on civilians? For example, suicide bombing on civilians. And the same question is directed to our friend from the Black Panthers Party. Now, what is your position on this complex question of violence and non-violence? And in what way will we be dealing with this?
Thank you. And then we'll just last right there, ma'am, and then we'll.
Thank you.
Oh, I meant, I'm sorry.
Not me.
Behind you, I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to ask if there were any other plans to have African American delegation going to Palestine. I think that's really important, especially campus leaders, because AIPAC and some of the other Zionist organizations are trying to co-opt some of the African American student leadership.
And then let's also hear from the woman. If for no other reason, we're Facebook friends. Can she also answer?
Okay. I just thank you all for your wonderful presentations. All of you were so moving and inspiring. And Janine, I was reading an article today on my interview with Lanny Simpson from, I don't know, more of Canada. Very moved by you. And I was thinking how non-Indigenous organizers have to learn from Indigenous ways of organizing, Indigenous ways of interacting, Indigenous ways of seeing the world. And I don't know, sometimes I find activism in New York, here it's like cold and intellectual. Like when you spoke, it was so warm and based on love and interacting and relationship building. And what efforts are there for non-Indigenous organizing to incorporate more of the wonderful, heartfelt concepts of Indigenous organizing touch the hearts and souls of so many people?
Okay, I'm going to recap those questions, and people, you don't have to take on all four of them at all. Maybe each person can take on one. There's the question of the prospect of building an international movement on the question of political prisoners. There's the question of violence. There's the very simple question of, are there going to be more African-American delegations to Palestine? And then the question, of course, of do you know how non-indigenous activist communities can incorporate indigenous practices?
I'll try to tackle. Well, in terms of political prisoners, it would be great to have an international campaign just to start with against G4S, which is functioning here in the United States, in Europe, and in Palestine, creating detention centers, interrogation centers, really bad company, and we could do a global BDS movement against G4S. And other companies that are working on surveillance, like Motorola Solutions. I think the model of the Palestinian BDS movement can be adopted by other people that are struggling, because again, it is fundamentally really a struggle against the military-industrial complex and the people that are profiting off of that. And I think that they are the same systems that are oppressing us, as I said. So I would say a global campaign against G4S would be good. We'd be happy. In terms of violence versus nonviolence and anti-occupation and people, Jewish supporters and Israeli supporters inside Israel, it's important to make a distinction between people that are against the occupation, only against the occupation, and people that are anti-Zionist. And the reason why I say that is ending the occupation of Palestine by itself, while good, or ending the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip while good, is not going to resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, because it does not address 60% of the Palestinian people who are living either as displaced refugees in the Arab world, inside Palestine and Israel, or as Israeli citizens. So you're kind of denying two-thirds of our people, and you cannot solve the Palestinian problem solely by looking towards ending the occupation. Having said that, we are working with a lot of anti-Zionist Jews, and I mentioned some, like Boycott From Within, like the Coalition of Women for Peace, who do an amazing website called Who Profits. It has information on all companies that are profiting from the Israeli occupation, including all of the ones that I mentioned tonight. And they provide amazing support for the international BDS movement, even though they can be targeted by the Israeli anti-boycott law. So that's real solidarity for me. These are people that are standing with me as equals in an understanding that the system is oppressing both of us. In responding to that system, I personally believe in a nonviolent approach, and it's not just so the West will be happy with me. I think that again, going back to the earlier statement, I think that if I use violence in trying to overcome the oppression that's being made against me, I'm using the same ideology, the same thinking that's oppressing me, and I'm internalizing that. And that violence, once internalized, is very hard to get rid of. And we see it. And what's hurting Palestinian communities inside Palestine right now, the most, I think, is that internalized violence, and that scares me. So it's important that I do support nonviolence, but I can tell you this. Living inside Palestine, seeing my aunt's chest, you know, burned from a sound bomb, holding a colleague's leg while it was bleeding because of shrapnel, sitting with my cousin, and we called it occupation sitting, because we were afraid the Israeli soldiers would come and find him a man alone and take him, having his house later shelled. All of these things does not make you very nonviolent. You feel very violent, and you feel angry, and we have to acknowledge that and understand that we cannot continue to ask Palestinians or any oppressed people to act nonviolently if we're not helping to remove the violence that's being perpetuated against them.
Question. But when you were asking, the first people that popped into my mind are very dear friends of mine who I do a lot of organizing with, and they're non-Indigenous.
And the way I feel like they've connected with my people and our cause so correctly was just by going through the process of healing themselves. And that's the main reason why, you know, we also need to get rid of this rhetoric of whiteness versus, you know, people of color. It's because we need to realize that this healing that needs to take place also needs to happen within the white community, and that we need to create spaces where we can all collectively address this conflicted, hateful, violent history that we've all inherited and move on and start working together to build communities together. But that healing process in itself, I think, is where love comes from, is where the understanding of each other and seeing each other past, you know, our skin color and past our collective experiences and past these superficial identifiers that have been constructed really comes in. Because with my people, you know, I can't really sit here and tell you, you know, how you can learn an indigenous system of organizing, because I'm trying to learn that with my own people. You know, we've lost so much of who we are and what our culture is through our history. But I think it's a process for people of every culture who's born in this day and time, and to remember that we're all indigenous to this world, and we all need to find and revive and reestablish that collective identity, because that's the only way we're going to establish peace and move forward.
In addition to answering the question about plans for future delegations to Palestine, I'm sure we'd love to hear your thoughts about the questions of violence, nonviolence, and political struggle, given your experience.
Okay, I want to just say that one of the things that I saw when I went to Palestine was that Palestinian people have embraced nonviolence like no other people that I've seen. In the midst of all the violence that is being perpetrated against them, everywhere we went in Palestinian villages, we saw an AK-47 in a circle crossed out. And they have made a commitment to nonviolence. And they have almost perfected it. And it's something that I think we all can learn from now, both Palestinians and here in America. In the movements of the 60s and 70s, we tried violence, as the Palestinians did too in the early years. And it took us only so far. And so now we have to try another way. And I think that we're both doing that, and we know that we will be successful. In terms of other delegations going to Palestine, other African American delegations, I talk to a lot of young people, and I'm constantly encouraging young African American people to take that trip, because there's so much that they could learn from it. And so we are, through the organization that I went with, we are working towards creating more African American delegations to go, because once you go over there and once you see and once you observe for yourself, there's no denying that that our struggles are connected, and that we have to link those two struggles and fight against it.
I think that's a terrific place to end, and I'm not only saying that because we have to be out of the church. Eric, do you want to speak to that about an international?
I'm sorry, Brother Shep. I didn't know if I had time. But, you know, when I was in Palestine, one of the things I saw was there were posters of their political prisoners everywhere. And I'm thinking to myself, how come we haven't done that in the U.S.? You know, our political prisoners are almost forgotten and so marginalized. Nobody knows who they are or where they're at or anything. And I think that we can learn from the way that the Palestinians make sure that their political prisoners are never forgotten. They're everywhere. The posters are everywhere. It's something that you cannot forget. And we're going to have to do the same thing here. We're going to have to make it as clear as possible that these political prisoners exist and who they are and where they're at, so they are not forgotten.
this has been one of the most incredible coming togethers of movement, culture, and arts that I've ever seen in my life. So I really want to thank, first of all, our panelists up here. Round of applause for Adala New York, Scientific Soul Sessions. Personal thank you to Sherry Wolf for extending the invitation, my friend Sherry over there. So thank you, Sherry. And please, on your way out, sign up for more information and check out the books. Enjoy each other's fellowship. Thank you very much to everyone.
And we have to thank David Ryan for agreeing to moderate. Thank you for doing an excellent job.
Thanks to the church! Thank you.